Hello and welcome to a new conversation about software engineering. My name is Lukas Dohmann and today on the CASE podcast we will talk about microservices. My guest is Eberhard Wolf. Eberhard is a colleague of mine working as a fellow at InnoQ. With over 15 years of experience as an architect and consultant, he's written multiple books. So welcome to the show, Eberhard.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote multiple books about microservices, right?
Yes. I wrote a book about microservices originally in German. It has been translated to English and Korean. And also I wrote a rather short book that you can actually get for free called The Microservices Primer that gives a very short introduction about what microservices are and why you might want to use them.
And the primer is in English as well?
Yeah, so there is an English and a German version for that. And great. I think we will put the links to those in the show notes.
Yeah, we will do that. So let's start with a short definition of microservices. What is, in your opinion, the definition of microservices?
Yeah, I think that's already a very good question because if you look at it, everybody has a different concept about what a microservice actually is. And I try to come up with a definition that is rather generic, so that basically says everything that we call microservice actually fits the definition. And the definition that I came up with is that a microservice is an individually deployable module. And the reason why I like the definition is because, first of all, it basically says that microservices are just modules, and that's a concept that we are very used to. And it also makes clear that you can either use microservices or different types of modularization, like, you know, Java packages or C++ namespaces or these kinds of modules that we are all used to in programming languages. And it also means that we can apply the ideas about or what good modules are also for microservices. So low cohesion, high cohesion and low coupling and these kinds of things. And the really new stuff is that they are individually deployable. So if you have a change to a module, you don't need to deploy all of your modules. You just deploy a single module. So in an e-commerce application, if there is a change to the order process, you just deploy the microservice that is responsible to the order process. And the rest of the system just stays as it is. So that's the way that I think about microservices and how I would define that term.
So for you, the core ideas are about deployment for microservices, right?
Yes. So that's what it sets them apart from other types of modularization. However, it's still modularization. So it's still about how do you split a system apart into specific parts.
Okay. And what do you think enabled all those ideas? Because there are a lot of different ideas about how to exactly do microservices, but they are all not that old, right?
Yes, that's true. If you look at it, the idea of modularization is very old, but the idea to have individually deployable modules is actually more recent. And I would argue that one of the reasons why we are doing that nowadays is because the cost for deployment has come down a lot. And that is because we have virtualization, that is because we have containers, so it's much easier to have a system to deploy software on. Nobody needs to go into a data center anymore and put another system into the rack. It is something that you just do in software. And also the deployment has been automated due to the continuous delivery movement. And I would argue, and that's also sort of how I approached the subject. So I wrote a book about continuous delivery. I thought that continuous delivery was really a huge step forward. And then I realized that continuous delivery is also something that would influence the architecture. And that is why I became interested in microservices. So I think there's a huge synergy between those two things.
So you're saying that continuous delivery enabled microservices or made it a consequence of continuous delivery?
Yes. So in a way, it enabled it, but it's also that if you want to do microservices, you need to have automated deployment in place. Microservices also support continuous delivery. So if you look at it, I would argue if you have a very large system that needs to be deployed as a whole, a deployment monolith, it will be hard to truly do continuous delivery because it will be very hard to even deploy it automatically. And also the feedback, the fast feedback that you aim for in continuous delivery will be rather slow because the unit is so large that you're deploying. So it takes a long time to deploy it. It takes a long time to test it and so on and so on. So I would argue on the one hand, you need to have that automation in place that continuous delivery provides. But at the same time, if you want to do continuous delivery, you should think about what you do with your architecture and whether your architecture should or how your architecture will support continuous delivery. And I think microservices are a good answer to that topic or to that challenge.
Okay, so what other advantages do you see in this architecture?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So if you look at it, a lot of people claim that the main problem that microservices solve is that large systems are rather hard to develop with large teams. So the usual story about microservices is, in fact, that people had a deployment monolith and they were throwing more developers on the deployment monolith to get more stuff done, and they realized that the deployment monolith is just too large and it's too hard to really do a lot with it. So what they did is they split it apart and built microservices instead. And I think that's a very valid point, and I would argue that it allows us to tackle problems that were really hard to tackle before. I mean, doing large projects has been a very tough challenge in the past. And in a way, microservices solve that problem because they split apart the system so much that you're rather doing a lot of small projects instead of one large project. So if you have all the decisions that you're making are usually limited to your microservice. So if you have a new feature, it will be implemented in one microservice, and even technical decisions can be made within just one microservice. So there is a lot of independence, and that allows the teams to work independently, and that solves that problem. Having said that, a lot of customers that I work with, actually, they have much smaller teams. So they have one or two Scrum teams. And obviously, in such environments, you don't really have the kind of challenges that you have if you have like 100 people working on a deployment monolith. I would still argue that there are a lot of advantages that you can gain in such scenarios. So we already spoke about continuous delivery. So that's obviously an advantage that you can get. There is a very interesting thing. So one thing that we are also struggling with as an industry is how do we actually make sure that our system stays maintainable in the long run? And the usual approach is to come up with a very great architecture and to make sure that that architecture will tackle the problem and solve it once and for all. And the problem that I have is usually when I go to a customer, they don't have that. Even though they tried, they don't have a clear architecture, and usually they have rather a mess. So I would argue the idea to make a system maintainable in the long run by building a very good architecture, it is something that a lot of people tried and most of them failed. And microservices have a different approach because what microservices basically say, well, if we mess up one microservice, we can just replace it. So I think that's a nice different approach. It doesn't say we are going to build that software and it's going to last forever, but rather we say if there's a problem with one piece of that software, we are going to replace it. And I think that's a nice alternative approach. The architecture between the microservices is very stable. Because there are the interfaces between the microservices, and that means that if you violate the architecture, if you build in a new dependency that shouldn't be there between microservices, you will notice that because you need to go through the interface of the microservice. While in a deployment monolith, usually these dependencies between modules are just randomly introduced by some developer, and maybe that developer doesn't really even notice how he or she is changing the architecture of the system and how new new dependencies are introduced, and that is something that in the microservices system you will notice that for sure.
So you're basically building a stronger walls between the modules, right? It's not that simple to get over those walls because it's very visible.
Exactly. The term that I'm using for that sometimes is architecture firewalls, sort of like splitting the system and making sure that at least that that kind of decomposition stays stable in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are some technical advantages. So, for example, you can scale each microservice individually. You can have you can limit or contain a security breach to just one microservice because there might be, you know, firewalls between them and they run on different systems. So I would argue that there are actually quite a few different different advantages on very different levels, technical levels, organizational levels, architectural levels. And that is also why I think that a very important point is to get to understand what type of goals you're trying to achieve by using microservices. Because depending on what your goals are, you might end up with a very different architecture and a different way of building your system. So, I mean, if you have a large system and it's about scaling your process and scaling your development in terms of developers working on it, it's probably going to be different what you're doing from a scenario where you're aiming for independent scalability, for example.
Mm-hmm. But do you also see disadvantages in this architecture?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I strongly believe that every type of architecture that you're using is actually a trade-off. And for that reason, there are clearly disadvantages in microservices. I would argue that the number one disadvantage is that the system becomes more complex to deploy and to operate, because basically what I'm saying is each module becomes an individually deployable thing that is running somewhere. So it might be a Docker container, for example. And that means that there is just so much more stuff running there. So if you have a system that contains of 50 modules, there are 15 times the number of things that you need to run in production. Mm-hmm. I think that is clearly one of the disadvantages. And there are some other problems. So it is somewhat harder to talk about the system as a whole. So if you want to do a refactoring where you really want to change the whole system, the complete architecture, it's going to be harder. I have to admit that I think that is not such a big problem, because if you want to do that kind of refactoring, it's probably going to be hard anyway, and there is a major problem probably, and I think it's going to cost a lot of effort anyway. So these kinds of refactoring will be hard anyway. It is harder with microservices, but that's probably something that is still fine. However, having said that, in a way it means that if you get the architecture wrong, if you get the split into modules wrong, it's probably going to be worse if you do microservices, because if you have a deployment monolith, you can still change all the modules and deploy them at once, while with microservices, you would need to do multiple deployments and you need to coordinate those deployments, and it's going to be harder. So if you have a messed up architecture, it's probably going to be worse if you implement that architecture using microservices. So I think that's probably one of the main problems that you have.
And also, you have a distributed system now, right?
Yes, you do. However, I would actually argue that the impact of that is rather limited. So what I keep saying is that a request that comes in should ideally be handled by just one microservice.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you do have a distributed system because there are microservices. So, and each request might be handled by a different microservice. but it should not be the common case that a request will be handled by multiple systems and that there are these kinds of dependencies. And in a way, what I'm just saying is that microservices are modules, so they should have low coupling, so they shouldn't really talk that much to one another. And I'm just rephrasing that. I'm just saying that they are a distributed system, and they still don't talk so much to one another because there's low coupling. So I think it sort of makes sense from that perspective too.
Okay, I think we will talk a little bit about communication later, but first Let's go into preconditions. What do you think a company has to fulfill before they can even start a microservice architecture, or can anybody just start with a microservice architecture?
I would argue that it's a global trade-off between making development probably easier and making operations somewhat harder. And for that reason, you need to have some kind of operations environment that actually supports that. I don't think that means... So in a way, that means you would have to have some DevOps culture. So you need to have some collaboration between development and operations. Because if you just do it without a DevOps culture, operations will have a hard time keeping up with all the microservices, making sure that all of them work and actually available. So development needs to support them. At the same time, operations needs to realize that they are up to a challenge, but it's worthwhile because it makes life easier for the dev department. My experience is actually that you don't need DevOps teams in the sense that one team is responsible for building the service and running it. So you build it, you run it approach. Mm-hmm. That's not strictly needed. It is rather that the operations department needs to support the dev department and vice versa. So there needs to be some collaboration. It's not that you need to have these DevOps teams that are fully responsible for the services. That's just my experience. So in practice, it is still fine to have teams, separated teams between development and operations. That's mm-hmm. the main point I would argue that you need to support.
Okay. So I heard that there are a lot of different styles of microservices. You said that there is no definition of microservices, but there are a few out there. Can you mention some of them and maybe the most important ones?
Yeah, so I would argue that the most radical approach that I know concerning microservices is what Fred George implements. There is an interview that I did with him on the SE Radio podcast where we go into a lot more detail. And basically, he says that a microservice is something that is like 100 or maybe 200 lines of code, and that can be pretty much replaced instantly. So that's an approach where you have really small-grained microservices, and communication between them is asynchronous. I have to admit that I'm not sure it is not an approach that I would propose if I was running a project, because frankly, I'm not sure how you can actually make that happen, because it is a lot of very small things that are running, and that means it's going to be very complex to actually support that. Mm-hmm. However, Fred has done that in a lot of different projects, so I think that it is something that definitely works in practice. So that's the most radical approach. It is something that you would probably nowadays would be able to do using serverless systems, where you can have functions of 100 lines of code or so, just type the code in the browser and run it on the Amazon cloud, and off you go. So that allows you to do more fine-grained services. The approach that a lot of people seem to be doing is what Netflix and a lot of other companies are doing, where you have microservices that are rather coarse-grained. So a Scrum team would handle one or maybe a few microservices, but not a lot of them. So it's more coarse-grained in that sense. And the approach that I see working in a lot of customers, or that has actually quite some good ideas, is the self-contained systems approach that has a similar level of granularity like the Netflix approach. But it's different because self-contained systems are supposed to have to be web applications. So they would include a UI and would therefore have an architecture where all the logic, all the data, and all the UI is in one service. And the big advantage is that if a customer requests a change to the system, it's very likely that it's going to be contained in one self-contained system, even if the customer wants to have a change to the UI and the logic and the persistence. It's going to be in one self-contained system, quite likely. So that's an advantage. And the other advantage is if you do it that way, there is not too much communication between self-contained systems if a request comes in. So let's imagine that you have, you know, a system that is responsible for the checkout in an e-commerce system and a system that is responsible for the invoicing. All the requests concerning checkout, the payment, and so on will be handled by one self-contained system. And there is just one communication where the order is handed over from the checkout to the invoicing, and that's it. So there's a lot of requests that are just handled by one self-contained system, and there is hardly a lot of communication between them. And that, again, fulfills the goal of the typical request being handled by just one self-contained system or microservice for that matter.
I think we have to mention Conway's Law at this point and maybe briefly describe what this is about, because I think we're talking around it a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, there is no talk about microservices that is complete without mentioning Conway's Law. So that's a classic. It's from, I believe, 68, and it basically claims that the architecture of a system is limited by the organizational structures. And the way that you can think about it is that if I'm building a component and someone else is building a component, we would have an interface between them. So if there is an architecture, we will probably spread the parts of the architecture, the components, to the different people, the different teams. So that is how the architecture influences the organization. And it's also the other way around. So if I'm part of a team, I will probably build something and someone else will build a different component. And then we will organize our work in that way. And then we will have an interface where we need to talk because of requirements that we might want to implement jointly. So communication structures will lead to something in the architecture. And again, if you have something in the architecture, it will lead to people talking to one another. And the interesting thing that microservices brought to the table concerning Conway's Law is, before microservices, Conway's Law was thought of as a limitation. So here's my organization. Let's assume that I built a team. That team is the UI team, and there is another team that is responsible for the database. And I do that because there are experts in these areas. So there are experts concerning databases and experts concerning UI. If I do it this way, which makes sense from an organizational standpoint, it means that I influence the architecture, and the architecture will have those technical artifacts. So there is a limitation concerning the architecture that you can actually build. And the new thing that microservices brought to the table is that the microservices people said, well, we have the ideal architecture, which is more like independent system. So we have some system that has a business functionality, such as the checkout. And we assign a team to that system. And that way we enforce the architecture using organizational measures. That is also what the Agile community mentions. So the Agile community also talks about cross-functional teams. So that's actually what we are doing there. We need to have teams that have UI experts, experts for domain logic, and also experts for databases. So we need to have cross-functional teams. There is one thing that is also sort of a synergy there. So I used to be part of a team like 15 years ago or so, where we actually had an order team. They were responsible for order. But we built a deployment monolith. So what's the difference to nowadays? Nowadays, it's not just that you have the functionality split apart. So, you know, some new feature will either be handled by the order team or by the checkout team or by some other team. It's also that technical decisions can be made by these teams, because they would just influence one of the microservices, and therefore there is more independence. So there is a synergy there, because microservices allow you to be more independent concerning technology. It is also easier to do that organizational thing.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Where do you see how to implement microservices? Do you think that it is a greenfield approach or a brownfield approach, or can it be both?
That's a very good point, and I think it's valuable to talk about it, because I think microservices are originally a brownfield approach. So usually the usual story that you see in conferences, and also that I see in customers, is so we have a deployment monolith, we hit the wall concerning the speed that we can do changes, so now we are splitting it apart into microservices. And I think that's actually great, because you know, migrating away from legacy applications is one of the huge challenges that we have as an industry. So microservices are another tool to do that. And I think it's also important because it's rather unsexy. So nowadays, people think microservices are fancy and cool and so on. And of course they are, but they also solve these old, unfancy, unsexy problems like legacy migration. So I think that's good, an important point to notice. It seems to me that, let's say in the last year or so, people are also building greenfield microservices systems. So that's, I would say, something that at least I see as a rather recent thing. And of course, you can do that. But, you know, at one point, someone stepped up to me and said, well, you know, microservices, it's all very cool, but you can only truly do that in a greenfield environment. And I was like, wow, that's a very strange comment, because to me, it is originally about brownfield, and I think it's a very valuable tool in that regard, because you can build a new system. You're not tied to the old technology, and you can gain advantages pretty soon without modifying a lot of the code in the legacy system. So I think it's a very valuable tool in that scenario.
Okay, one question is, how do we handle all this complexity in microservices?
That's a good point. I mean, on the one hand, microservices are, of course, complex. So we already spoke about how deployment and operations become much more complex. I would argue that microservices are actually a simple solution. I mean, people shouldn't be using an architecture because it's complex, and I actually believe they don't do that. They do it because it's the simplest solution around. So if you look at it, there are a lot of advantages, like these really decoupled systems from a technology perspective and also from a functional perspective, and easier scalability and so on and so on. So there's a lot of stuff to be gained. However, of course, there are some disadvantages, primarily in the space of operations. And that's the trade-off. And I would argue if that trade-off is positive, so if you gain more than you lose, you should do microservices. And then chances are that microservices are a simple, or probably even the simplest solution. And I think that is, I mean, that's how the whole concept even was created, because people were trying to build systems that they could not possibly build without using microservices, because otherwise they would be too complex. And I think that's a very important point to note. It is not that microservices are complex, it's a trade-off, and you should only do it if it's actually a simple solution, not a complex solution. I would never voluntarily choose a complex architecture because, well, that will backfire on me.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. So you said in the beginning that each microservice should be able to handle a request all by itself. How does that work?
Yeah, so that's just another way of saying that the modules, the microservices, have low coupling and high cohesion. So each microservice will hardly talk to other microservices, basically means that they are lowly coupled to one another. The question is, how do you make sure that your systems are structured in that way? And I think the best tool that we have to do that is domain-driven design. So domain-driven design is a way of structuring software that has been introduced by Eric Evans in more than 10 years ago. And he wrote that book about domain-driven design. And among other things, he basically said that if I have a domain model, it's actually limited to one bounded context. So it's only valid in that one bounded context. And in a way, that's trivial. So if I have a system that in the e-commerce area, I have my domain model in that system. And of course, my customer will have a completely different domain model, as will my suppliers and other systems that I interact with. However, even in such a system, like an e-commerce system, I can probably identify bounded contexts. So I could say, okay, if I'm looking for to search for products, well, I'm basically interested in what the product looks like, maybe definitely the price and a lot of other attributes like the size of a t-shirt and the color of a t-shirt and all these kinds of things. So that's for the product search. And then if I try to send out that product to someone, what I'm actually interested in is in which warehouse is it stored? How much does it weigh? How can I actually ship it? So is it something that needs to have some kind of special handling and so on and so on? So those are very different things that you need to know about products. And of course, there is a completely different domain model. So all of the other entities will be handled differently too, and the logic will be different and so on and so on. And what domain-driven design says is, let's have domain models for each of these bounded contexts. And that way we can get a much clearer and easier specialized domain model instead of overdoing it and making it too complex. And if you have a microservice that is actually one bounded context or implements a bounded context, they will be very independent. So all of the logic, and because the domain model also includes the data, also all of the data will be in that one microservice and it will be handled there, and that's it. So they hardly need to talk to one another. Of course, there is some communication because they are still part of a system, but it's not a lot of communication. And that is, I think, the key to make sure that microservices don't talk to one another. The other interesting thing is, so, of course, systems need to talk to one another. And if you look at the more recent ideas in domain-driven design, actually, they say that those bounded contexts will probably talk to one another using events. So, you know, something like, okay, here is a new order, and please write an invoice for that or make sure that the delivery goes out. So from the domain-driven design perspective, they propose that you should use events. And that is also, that can be easily translated to asynchronous communication, which is advantageous for microservices because it allows more resilience and it solves the problems around, well, the distributed system. So distributed systems, of course, have the problem that systems might be down, but if you have asynchronous communication, it just means that the system will eventually come up, and at that point, the message will be transferred, and you're fine, and your system will probably deal with a higher latency, but you have to be aware of that latency anyway, because you're using asynchronous communication, and asynchronous communication by definition includes a higher latency. So there is a nice synergy there again, because basically domain-driven design gives us more than just bounded context. It also sort of enforces asynchronous communication between the bounded contexts, even though it's actually just events, but they can easily be implemented using asynchronous communication. And that's quite nice, because it again solves problems that we have in these distributed systems where communication might fail, systems might be down, and you know, you need to take care about the resilience and how the system survives if some parts of the system fail.
Okay, but when each request is handled by mainly one microservice, how do I get from one request to one microservice to another one? So how do they integrate with each other?
Yeah, so a very simple thing to do that, and that is why I think the idea around self-contained systems is so powerful. You can just say, okay, well, I'm going to render an HTML page in one microservice, and then there's a link to another HTML page. So, you know, if you want to go from your search system to the checkout, it's just going to be a link. So that would be one way of doing that. Or if you want to go from the product search to a product detail page, it's just going to be a link, and so on and so on. So that's one way of doing it. And by the way, there are also other nice things that you can do using front-end integration. So maybe there is a feature plan that says I need to have all the information about a customer on one page. Well, how do you do that? You could store all the information about a customer in one microservice, but that would be a lot of replication of data and, you know, a lot of events that need to be handled. So an alternative might be to say, well, here is a page, and it's going to be composed from content that is provided by the different bounded contexts, that and it's all displayed on one page. And you know, if you have the homepage of your e-commerce system, you might have one part that is filled by a system that is responsible for recommendation, another one that is responsible for giving you an idea about what the state of your last orders are, and so on and so on and so on. So you know, these overviews can be handled on the UI level. And the nice thing about it, again, is that it's really low coupling, because all these systems need to do is they need to be able to render that page, and that's it. So, of course, there is some integration. So there is CSS, for example, that might be shared, and, you know, there is a look and feel that you need to agree on. But if you want to display completely different information, that's fine. You can just do it, and it would just be a change to one self-contained system. So that's one way of doing it. The asynchronous communication basically, and the events basically mean that, in a way, there is a kind of a data replication, even though I'm not sure whether that's the correct term that I would use. So I mean, what I'm trying to say is, so there are events, like, for example, here is a new order. And of course, that will mean that there is information being stored in the invoicing system, and there is information being stored or processed in the system that actually triggers the delivery, but it's going to be very different information. So it's not really a replication. It's more like there is an event, and that leads to a system's storing data somewhere and doing that kind of stuff. And of course, there is still the possibility to do synchronous integration. Actually, if you look at the Netflix architecture, they rely a lot on synchronous communication. But in that case, you need to deal with the problem that a system might be down, and you need to build in some resilience in one way or another. So you need to deal with that. And that's why I would rather stay away from it. However, there are still cases where you would need to use synchronous communication. And that is when you want to make sure that there is a consistent view on the data. So, I mean, the mm-hmm. only way that you can get a high level of consistency is by having one system that has the data and all of the systems doing synchronous call to get the most up-to-date information about the data. Because that way, you eliminate the event mechanism, the asynchronous communication, and the lag time that you might have between different systems processing the events. But apart from that, I would rather stay away from synchronous communication. So it is an option, but I would rather stay away from it. And that is clearly a different approach from what Netflix, for example, is doing.
Okay, but all of that means that the database between those services is not shared, right? They all have their own database.
Yes, so at least they have a different database schema. And that's just a result of bounded context. So if you have your own domain model, you have to somehow store the information in that model. And for that reason, you need to have your own schema that you can independently change, and where you can, you know, add some data or remove data or whatever. So that's, I think, quite clear. Now the question is, does that mean that you have to have a different database for each system? So You might argue that's a good idea because, well, polyglot persistence basically told us that there are different databases like graph databases, relational databases, and document stores, and they have different advantages and disadvantages. And for that reason, you probably want to have a different database in each system. And I would argue that's actually the case also in more traditional architectures. So if I have some kind of search, it's usually done by some specialized search system. So it's not that uncommon to actually have a specialized persistence solution for a specific bounded context or a specific microservice. Having said that, there is a problem. So if a microservice uses a different programming language, or let's say just a different Java framework, from an operations perspective, that's not that much of a difference. So, you know, whether I have a Java process that runs that jar or that jar doesn't really make a lot of difference. But for databases, it's different because those databases, they actually store data, and you know that data should not be lost. So you need to have some kind of backup, you need to have some kind of disaster recovery. And that means sort of the cost or the effort to have a lot of databases running in your system is quite high. And for that reason, I think it's fine if you have one database or just a set of databases that you support, or maybe just even one database instance that all of your microservices use. It's, again, a trade-off. So that would probably be cheaper, but it also has drawbacks. So, I mean, if that database fails, all of your systems fail. So that's not a good thing, of course.
And the deployments are not as independent as they would have been if they have their own databases, right?
Right. So you do introduce some dependencies concerning deployments. You do introduce dependencies concerning availability. And, you know, I think that might be a valid trade-off. It depends on what you're trying to achieve and what you're trying to do. And of course, I mean, you can if you, at one point you figure out that you should rather have separated databases, you can do that probably without a lot of effort.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we have multiple services and we now want to do testing, how does that work?
That's, again, a good point, and it is often forgotten. So, as I said, I think microservices have independent deployment as the main characteristic of them. And to actually achieve independent deployment, you have to have independent tests too. So, because if I have my microservice and I run through my deployment pipeline, and then there is some integration test, and there is a different microservice that is just being integration tested, I can probably not pass that stage because first we need to check whether the microservice that is currently being integration tested is correct before I can enter that stage, because otherwise it's not clear whether my microservice or the other microservice is actually the one that made the integration test fail. Mm-hmm. So there is a bottleneck. And if you have, in particular, if you have a migration scenario where you have your deployment monolith and you want to split it apart into microservices, it's very tempting to just take the tests that you have for your deployment monolith and declare them integration tests for the microservices. And then you do have that bottleneck, and it's going to be a huge bottleneck. So for that reason, you need to separate those tests too. Now, a problem is, how could that possibly work? Because, of course, there might be things that must be tested in integration tests. So some functionalities that can only really be tested if you have all of your microservices working together. First of all, let me just say that if you have bounded context, that should not be common. It should be the exception. So mm-hmm. That is one way of sort of dealing with that problem, or at least realizing that it might not be that bad. The other thing is, if you think about it, what's the purpose of an integration test? The purpose of an integration test is to make sure that systems work together, that the integration works. It's not called acceptance tests. It is not something where you test whether the software is actually something that the customer would accept. So can we do acceptance tests without integrating all the modules? Well, it turns out you can. So if I have my system, let's say there is an order system and it talks to an invoicing system, I can check my system with a stub for the invoicing system. And that's something that is rather common, you know. So if I have the invoicing system, if it is something that people now also do. So instead of running the real invoicing system, I just have a stub that behaves in the way that I intend it to behave. And, there's still a problem, because what about the invoicing system? That one might actually have a problem. It might not behave in the way that I expect it to behave. So that is where consumer-driven contract tests come in. That's something that is also like at least 10 years old. The idea is like 10 years old. And the idea is basically to write a test. So I write a test for invoicing, and I pass it over to invoicing and I say, this is the way that I intend to use your system. So, you know, I do this call, I expect that result. I do this call, I expect that result, and so on and so on. And the nice thing is that now the invoicing system can be tested for correctness, or in an acceptance test, without my system, but instead we would use the consumer-driven contract test. And that means that now we have two systems that actually talk to one another, but whether they work together correctly can be tested in separated deployment pipelines. So I can test whether my system does the right thing by using a stub, and they can use the consumer-driven contract test that I will provide them to make sure that their system works correctly. Now, you might argue, well, that's all nice, but, you know, how can I make sure that the consumer-driven contract test and the stub are actually like the real thing? And of course, that's a challenge. But what you also have to think about is that the risk of an individual deployment is lower because you do much more frequent deployments because of continuous delivery. And also, I just change one microservice in each deployment, so the risk is lower. And that means that you can have alternative approaches and alternative things that you can do, like you can roll back to the last deployment if there is a problem in production. So I would argue that it's not just about doing tests, it's also about the lower risk of deployments that continuous delivery and microservices give you. And I think that's in particular important if you're looking at performance testing, because I would argue that it's very hard to get performance testing right and to actually get a production-like system, all the production data, I mean, and simulate the user behavior, particularly if there are new features. Who knows how those features will be used? And in particular, in that case, I would rather rely on monitoring the ability to do some elastic scaling, the ability to deploy fixes quickly in production, and so on to solve performance problems. So I think with microservices, we also have to think more about monitoring, getting deployments quickly out as something that would also lower the risk of problems in production and making it easier to actually solve problems that you might have in production.
But in a way, the CDC would enable us to make the contracts between services more explicit, right? We don't only have those firewalls between the systems, but we also know where the doors between those areas are, right?
Right. So I would fully agree, and I think if you do any kind of interface between teams or developers, you might want to do it using some kind of consumer-driven contract tests, because there are just so many advantages to be gained out of that. So it's a clear definition about interface of the interface. It clearly spells out how the interface will be used, and it also means that the interface is more changeable, because if the invoicing system wants to change their interface, they can just do it and without talking to anyone, and they can just see whether the consumer-driven contract test will fail. And if it does, they obviously did something that they shouldn't have done. And, you know, then they can just go back and say, okay, well, we are not going to do that, or we need to really talk to that team. While if you don't have that, it's much harder to change the interface, because you might not even be aware of who uses that interface and how. And, you know, then it's more like, okay, are we going to do that change? What are we going to break? I don't know. So let's rather not do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we would want to sum up the discussion, what would be your main takeaways for implementing microservices?
Yeah, so currently I have somewhat mixed feelings, because I think microservices are very fashionable, and there are some, let's say, strange things that I see out in the world, like people who want to implement or use microservices but are not sure why they are doing that. So I think if you ask me, it comes down to the question, what are your goals? And then you can find an architecture. And I think microservices bring a lot to the table. So as I said, for large systems, they make development much easier. They might even help you to solve organizational issues and, you know, communication issues that you might have. So that's great. It is an excellent tool if you want to do continuous delivery. I would not introduce continuous delivery without thinking about the architecture and whether you want to do microservices or not. And also, I think the focus that we're seeing nowadays after, like, what is it, like almost 15 years concerning domain-driven design, I really like that, because it's such a powerful approach. So there is a renaissance about a lot of things, like domain-driven design, resilience, and these kinds of things. And I think it's great that they are getting into the spotlight again. Having said that, the way that I see microservices now, it's another tool, and it has a lot of advantages. And I would use it as sort of an inspiration about what you can do in your current environment and in your current context to solve the problems at hand. So that's the way that I look at it and the way that I would handle it. And what that means is, I think, for example, domain-driven design makes a lot of sense, but maybe in your system, it's still fine to do a deployment monolith that has a structure that is inspired or that implements domain-driven design. And I think that's a very valid decision, and I would prefer that over a decision where you're doing microservices, but you can't really spell out why you're doing that, and you can't really mention the reasons. So if there is a conscious decision about doing a deployment monolith, but using some approaches like domain-driven design to structure it. I think that's excellent if it solves your problem. If microservices solve your problem, and I would argue probably they will, then you should use that and use that approach. And I think, yeah, it helps a lot with a lot of problems that we are seeing nowadays. Of course, we want to provide, we want to get out our software more quickly. Of course, we have larger teams. Of course, the things are becoming more complex, and that is where microservices really shine.
Okay, so thank you for talking to me. This was another episode of the Case Podcast. Yeah, have a nice day.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.